This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Sleeping Giants by Sylvan Neuvel. Read for you by Andy Secom, Eric Myers, Laurel Lefko, Charlie Anson, Liza Ross, William Hope, Christopher Ragland, Catherine Mangold, and Adna Sablich. Prologue.
It was my 11th birthday. I'd gotten a new bike from my father, white and pink, with tassels on the handles. I really wanted to ride it, but my parents didn't want me to leave while my friends were there. They weren't really my friends, though. I was never really good at making friends. I liked reading, I liked walking in the woods, I liked being alone. And I always felt a little out of place with other kids my age. So when birthdays came by, my parents usually invited the neighbors' kids over. There were a lot of them, some whose names I barely knew. They were all very nice and they all brought gifts. So I stayed. I blew out the candles. I opened the presents. I smiled a lot. I can't remember most of the gifts because all I could think about was getting out and trying that bicycle. It was about dinner time by the time everyone left, and I couldn't wait another minute. It would soon be dark. Once it was, my father wouldn't let me leave the house until morning. I snuck out the back door and pedaled as fast as I could into the woods at the end of the street. It must have been 10 minutes before I started slowing down. Perhaps it was getting a little too dark for comfort, and I was thinking about going back. Maybe I was just tired. I stopped for a minute, listening to the wind throwing the branches around. Fall had arrived. The forest had turned into a motley landscape and given new depth to the hillsides. The air suddenly got cold and wet as if it were about to rain. The sun was going down and the sky behind the trees was as pink as those tassels. I heard a crack behind me. It could have been a hare. Something drew my eye to the bottom of the hill. I left my bicycle on the trail and started slowly making my way down, moving branches out of my way. It was hard to see, as the leaves hadn't fallen yet, but there was this eerie turquoise glow seeping through the branches. I couldn't pinpoint where it came from. It wasn't the river. I could hear that in the distance, and the light was much closer. It seemed to be coming from everything. I got to the bottom of the hill, then the ground disappeared from under my feet. I don't remember much after that. I was out for several hours, and the sun was coming up when I came to. My father was standing about 50 feet above me. His lips were moving, but I couldn't hear a sound. The hole I was in was perfectly square, about the size of our house. The walls were dark and straight, with bright, beautiful turquoise light shining out of intricate carvings. There was light coming out of just about everything around me. I moved my hands around a bit. I was lying on a bed of dirt, rocks, and broken branches. Underneath the debris, the surface was slightly curved, smooth to the touch and cold, like some type of metal. I hadn't noticed them before, but there were firemen above, yellow jackets buzzing around the hole. A rope fell a few feet from my head. Soon I was strapped onto a stretcher and hoisted into daylight. My father didn't want to talk about it afterward. When I asked what I had fallen into, he just found new clever ways of explaining what a hole was. It was about a week later that someone rang the doorbell. I called for my father to go, but I got no answer. I ran down the stairs and opened the door. It was one of the firemen that had gotten me out of the hole. He'd taken some pictures and thought I'd like to see them. He was right. There I was, this tiny little thing at the bottom of the hole, lying on my back, in the palm of a giant metal hand.
Part 1. Body Parts. File number 003. Interview with Dr. Rose Franklin, Ph.D., Senior Scientist, Enrico Fermi Institute. Location: University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois.
How big was the hand?
6.9 meters, about 23 feet, though it seemed much larger for an 11-year-old.
What did you do after the incident?
Nothing. We didn't talk about it much after that. I went to school every day like any kid my age. No one in my family had ever been to college, so they insisted I keep going to school. I majored in physics. I know what you're going to say. I wish I could tell you I went into science because of the hand. But I was always good at it. My parents figured out I had a knack for it early on. I must have been 4 years old when I got my first science kit for Christmas. One of those electronics kits. You could make a telegraph or things like that by squeezing wires into little metal springs. I don't think I would have done anything different had I listened to my father and stayed home that day. Anyway, I graduated from college, and I kept doing the only thing I knew how to do. I went to school. You should have seen my dad when we learned I was accepted at the University of Chicago. I've never seen anyone so proud in my life. He wouldn't have been any happier had he won $1 million. They hired me at the U of C after I finished my PhD.
When did you find the hand again?
I didn't. I wasn't looking for it. It took 17 years, but I guess you could say it found me.
What happened?
To the hand? The military took over the site when it was discovered.
When was that?
When I fell in. It took about 8 hours before the military stepped in. Colonel Hudson, I think that was his name, was put in charge of the project. He was from the area, so he knew pretty much everyone. I don't remember ever meeting him, but those who did had only good things to say about the man. I read what little was left of his notes. Most of it was redacted by the military. In the 3 years he spent in charge, his main focus had always been figuring out what those carvings meant. The hand itself, which is mostly referred to as the artifact, is mentioned in passing only a few times, evidence that whoever built that room must have had a complex enough religious system. I think he had a fairly precise notion of what he wanted this to be.
What do you think that was?
I have no idea. Hudson was career military. He wasn't a physicist. He wasn't an archaeologist. He had never studied anything resembling anthropology, linguistics, anything that would be remotely useful in this situation. Whatever preconceived notion he had, it must have come from popular culture, watching Indiana Jones or something. Fortunately for him, he had competent people surrounding him. Still, it must have been awkward, being in charge and having no idea what's going on most of the time. What's fascinating is how much effort they put into disproving their own findings. Their first analysis indicated the room was built about 3,000 years ago. That made little sense to them, so they tried carbon dating organic material found on the hand. The tests showed it to be much older, somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 years old.
That was unexpected.
You could say that. You have to understand that this flies in the face of everything we know about American civilizations. The oldest civilization we're aware of was located in the Norte Chico region of Peru, and the hand appeared to be about 1,000 years older. Even if it weren't, it's fairly obvious that no one carried a giant hand from South America all the way to South Dakota, and there were no civilizations as advanced in North America until much, much later. In the end, Hudson's team blamed the carbon dating on contamination from surrounding material. After a few years of sporadic research, the site was determined to be 1,200 years old and classified as a worship temple for some offshoot of Mississippian civilization. I went through the files a dozen times. There's absolutely nothing, no evidence whatsoever to support that theory, other than the fact that it makes more sense than anything the data would suggest. If I had to guess, I would say that Hudson saw no military interest whatsoever in all this. He probably resented seeing his career slowly wither in an underground research lab and was eager to come up with anything, however preposterous, just to get out of there.
Did he?
Get out? Yes. It took a little more than 3 years, but he finally got his wish. He had a stroke while walking his dog and slipped into a coma. He died a few weeks later.
What happened to the project after he died?
Nothing. Nothing happened. The hand and panels collected dust in a warehouse for 14 years until the project was demilitarized. Then the University of Chicago took over the research with NSA funding, and somehow I was put in charge of studying the hand I fell in when I was a child. I don't really believe in fate, but somehow small world doesn't begin to do this justice.
Why would the NSA get involved in an archaeological project?
I asked myself the same question. They fund all kinds of research, but this seems to fall outside their usual fields of interest. Maybe they were interested in the language for cryptology. Maybe they had an interest in the material the hand is made of. In any case, they gave us a pretty big budget, so I didn't ask too many questions. I was given a small team to handle the hard science before we handed everything over to the anthropology department. The project was still classified as top secret, and just like my predecessor, I was moved into an underground lab. I believe you've read my report, so you know the rest.
Yes, I have read it. You sent your report after only 4 months. Some might think it was a little hasty.
It was a preliminary report, but yes, I don't think it was premature. Okay, maybe a little, but I had made significant discoveries, and I didn't think I could go much further with the data that I had, so why wait? There is enough in that underground room to keep us guessing for several lifetimes. I just don't think we have the knowledge to get much more out of this without getting more data.
Who is we?
Us. Me. You. Mankind. Whatever. There are things in that lab that are just beyond our reach right now.
Okay. So, tell me about what you do understand. Tell me about the panels.
It's all in my report. There are 16 of them, approximately 10 feet by 32 feet each, less than an inch thick. All 16 panels were made around the same period, approximately 3,000 years ago.
If I may, I take it you do not subscribe to the cross-contamination theory.
As far as I'm concerned, there's no real reason not to trust the carbon dating. And to be honest, how old these things are is the least of our problems. Did I mention the symbols have been glowing for the last 17 years with no apparent power source? Each wall is made of 4 panels and has a dozen rows of 18 to 20 symbols carved into it. Rows are divided into sequences of 6 or 7 symbols. We counted 15 distinct symbols in total. Most are used several times. Some appear only once. 7 of them are curvy, with a dot in the center. 7 are made of straight lines, and 1 is just a dot. They are simple in design, but very elegant.
Had the previous team been able to interpret any of the markings?
Actually, one of the few sections of Hudson's report left intact by the military was the linguistic analysis. They had compared the symbols to every known writing system, past or present, but found no interesting correlation. They assumed each sequence of symbols represented a proposition, like an English sentence, but with no frame of reference, they couldn't even speculate as to their interpretation. Their work was thorough enough and documented at every step. I saw no reason to do the same thing twice, and I declined the offer to add a linguist to the team. With nothing to compare this to, there was logically no way to arrive at any sort of meaning. Perhaps I was biased because I stumbled onto it, but I felt drawn to the hand. I couldn't explain it, but every fiber of my being was telling me the hand was the important piece.
Quite a contrast from your predecessor. So, what can you tell me about it?
Well, it's absolutely stunning. But I assume you're not that interested in aesthetics. It measures 22.6 feet in length from the wrist to the tip of the middle finger. It seems to be solid, made of the same metallic material as the wall panels, but it's at least 2,000 years older. It is dark gray, with some bronze overtones, and it has subtle iridescent properties. The hand is open, fingers close together, slightly bent, as if holding something very precious, or a handful of sand, trying not to spill it. There are grooves where human skin would normally fold, others that seem purely decorative. All are glowing the same bright turquoise which brings out the iridescence in the metal. The hand looks strong, but sophisticated is the only word that comes to mind. I think it's a woman's hand.
I am more interested in facts at this point. What is this strong but sophisticated hand made of?
It proved nearly impossible to cut or otherwise alter by conventional means. It took several attempts to remove even a small sample from one of the wall panels. Mass spectrography showed it to be an alloy of several heavy metals, mostly iridium, with about 10% iron and smaller concentrations of osmium, ruthenium, and other metals of the platinum group.
It must be worth its weight in gold.
It's funny you should mention that. It doesn't weigh as much as it should, so I'd say it's worth a lot more than its weight in anything.
How much does it weigh?
32 metric tons. I know it's a respectable weight, but it's inexplicably light given its composition. Iridium is one of the densest elements, arguably the densest, and even with some iron content, the hand should easily weigh 10 times as much.
How did you account for that?
I didn't. I still can't. I couldn't even speculate as to what type of process could be used to achieve this. In truth, the weight didn't bother me nearly as much as the sheer amount of iridium I was looking at. Iridium is not only one of the densest things you can find, it's also one of the rarest. You see, metals of this group, platinum is one of them, love to bond with iron. That's what most of the iridium on Earth did millions of years ago when the surface was still molten. And because it's so heavy, it sunk to the core, thousands of miles deep. What little is left in the Earth's crust is usually mixed with other metals, and it takes a complex chemical process to separate them.
How rare is it in comparison to other metals?
It's rare. Very rare. Let's put it this way. If you were to put together all the pure iridium produced on the entire planet in a year, you'd probably end up with no more than a couple metric tons. That's about a large suitcase full. It would take decades using today's technology to scrounge up enough to build all this. It's just too scarce on Earth, and there simply aren't enough chondrites lying around.
You lost me.
Sorry, meteorites? Stony ones? Iridium is so rare in Earth rocks that it is often undetectable. Most of the iridium we mine is extracted from fallen meteorites that didn't completely burn up in the atmosphere. To build this room, and it seems safe to assume that this is not the only thing they would have built, you'd need to find it where there are a lot more than on the Earth's surface.
Journey to the center of the Earth?
Jules Verne is one way to go. To get this type of metal in massive quantities, you'd either have to extract it thousands of miles deep, or be able to mine in space. With all due respect to Mr. Verne, we haven't come close to mining deep enough. The deepest mines we have would look like potholes next to what you'd need. Space seems much more feasible. There are private companies right now hoping to harvest water and precious minerals in space in the very near future. But all these projects are still in the early planning stages. Nonetheless, if you could harvest meteorites in space, you could get a lot more iridium. A whole lot more.
What else can you tell me?
That pretty much sums it up. After a few months of looking at this with every piece of equipment known to man, I felt we were getting nowhere. I knew we were asking the wrong questions, but I didn't know the right ones. I submitted a preliminary report and asked for a leave of absence.
Refresh my memory. What was the conclusion of that report?
We didn't build this.
Interesting. What was their reaction?
Request granted.
That was it?
Yes. I think they were hoping I wouldn't come back. I never used the word alien, but that's probably all they took out of my report.
That is not what you meant?
Not exactly. There might be a much more down-to-earth explanation, one I just didn't think of. As a scientist, all I can say is that humans of today do not have the resources, the knowledge, or the technology to build something like this. It's entirely possible that some ancient civilization's understanding of metallurgy was better than ours. But there wouldn't have been any more iridium around, whether it was 5,000, 10,000, or 20,000 years ago. So, to answer your question, no, I don't believe humans built these things. You can draw whatever conclusion you want from that. I'm not stupid. I knew I was probably putting an end to my career. I certainly annihilated any credibility I had with the NSA. But what was I going to do? Lie?
What did you do after you submitted your report?
I went home, to where it all began. I hadn't gone home in nearly 4 years, not since my father died.
Where is home?
I come from a small place called Deadwood, about an hour northwest of Rapid City.
I am not familiar with that part of the Midwest.
It's a small town built during the Gold Rush. It was a rowdy place, like in the movies. The last brothels were closed when I was a kid. Our claim to fame, besides a short-lived TV show on HBO, is that the murder of Wild Bill Hickok happened in Deadwood. The town survived the end of the Gold Rush and a few major fires, but the population dwindled to about 1,200. Deadwood sure isn't thriving, but it's still standing, and the landscape is breathtaking. It's sitting right on the edge of the Black Hills National Forest, with its eerie rock formations, beautiful pine forests, barren rock, canyons, and creeks. I can't think of a more beautiful place on Earth. I can understand why someone would want to build something there.
You still call it home?
Yes. It's part of who I am. Although my mother would probably disagree. She appeared hesitant when she answered the door. We barely spoke anymore. I could sense that she resented the fact that I never came back, not even for Dad's funeral, that I left her all alone to cope with the loss. We all have our way of dealing with pain, and I suppose that deep down my mother understood that this was just my way. But there was anger in her voice, things she would never dare to speak out loud. But that would taint our relationship forever. I was okay with that. She had suffered enough. She was entitled to resentment. We didn't talk much the first few days, but we quickly settled into some form of routine. Sleeping in my old room brought back memories. When I was a child, I often snuck out of bed at night and sat by the window to watch my dad leave for the mine. He would come to my room before every night shift and have me pick a toy to put in his lunchbox. He said he would think of me when he opened it and come spend his lunch break with me in my dreams. He didn't talk much to me or to my mother, but he knew how important little things can be for a child, and he took the time to tuck me in before every shift. How I wished my dad were there so I could talk to him. He wasn't a scientist, but he had a clear view of things. I couldn't talk to my mother about this. We'd been having short but pleasant discussions for a few days, which was a welcome change from the polite comments about food we'd been exchanging since I arrived. But what I did was classified, and I did my best to steer our conversations away from what was on my mind. It got easier with every week that went by, as I found myself spending more time reminiscing about childhood mistakes than I did thinking about the hand. It took nearly a month before I hiked to the site where I'd first seen it. The hole had long since been filled. There were small trees starting to grow back through the dirt and rocks. There was nothing left to see. I walked aimlessly until nightfall. Why did I find the hand first? Surely there must be other structures, like the one I fell in. Why did no one find them? Why did it happen on that day? The hand had been dormant for millennia. Why did it happen then? What triggered it? What was present 20 years ago that hadn't been for thousands of years? Then it hit me. That was the right question to ask. I had to figure out what turned it on.
File number 004. Interview with CW3 Kara Resnick, United States Army. Location, Coleman Army Airfield, Mannheim, Germany.
Please state your name and rank.
You already know my name. You're staring at my file.
I was told you would cooperate with this process. I would like you to state your name for the record.
Maybe you could start by telling me what this process is about.
I cannot do that. Now, state your name and rank for the record.
I cannot do that. Do you over-articulate everything all the time?
I like to enunciate things. I find it allows me to avoid misunderstandings. If there is one thing I loathe, it is to repeat myself.
Yes, my name. You can say it if it's so important to you.
As you wish. You are Chief Warrant Officer 3, Kara Resnick, and you are a helicopter pilot in the United States Army. Is that correct?
Was. I've been removed from flight status, but you probably know that already.
I did not. May I ask what happened?
I have a detached retina. It doesn't hurt, but my vision is affected. I'm scheduled for surgery tomorrow. When I asked, they said there's a reasonable chance I might be able to fly again, which sounds suspiciously like no to me. What did you say your name was again?
I have not.
Then why don't you? For the record.
There are many reasons why, some more relevant than others. From your perspective, it should suffice to know that you would never be allowed to leave this room alive if I did.
You could have just said no. Do you really think threatening me will get you anywhere?
I sincerely apologize if you felt threatened in any way, Chief Resnick. It was never my intention to make you uncomfortable. I simply did not want you to think I was being coy.
So you were concerned for my safety? How chivalrous. Why am I here?
You are here to talk about what happened in Turkey.
Nothing happened in Turkey. Nothing interesting, anyway.
I will be the judge of that. You know that my clearance is several levels above yours, so start at the beginning.
I'm not even sure what that means.
How did you end up in Turkey?
I was called on NATO duty. I arrived early in the morning and got some sleep. Mission briefing was at 1600. They introduced me to my second, C.W. Mitchell, and we went over the mission. We would fly out at 0200 on a modified stealth UH-60 out of Adana. We were to enter Syrian airspace at very low altitude and collect air samples about 12 miles south of the border, near Araka.
You said you had never met your second in command. It is my understanding that the Army likes to keep its crews together. It seems odd for them to break up a team just before a dangerous mission and have you fly with someone you barely know. Why not have your usual co-pilot come with you?
He was reassigned.
Why is that?
You'd have to ask him.
I did. Would it surprise you to know he asked for any post as long as it was with another pilot? I believe the words he used to describe you were obdurate, volatile, and irascible. He has quite the vocabulary.
He plays a lot of Scrabble.
Is that why you did not get along?
I never had a problem with him.
That seems somewhat beside the point. You do not often see people willing to jeopardize their military career simply to avoid having to spend time with another person.
We disagreed over a lot of things, but I never let it get in the way of our flying. I can't help it if he wasn't able to do the same.
So it is not your fault if people have a problem with you. That is just who you are.
Something like that? Look. You want me to say I'm not the easiest person to get along with? I'll give you that. But somehow, I don't think we're here to discuss my charming personality. You want to know how I crashed a $20 million helicopter into the middle of a pistachio farm. Is that it?
We can start with that. You said you were supposed to collect air samples. Do you know why?
NATO believes that Syria has been pursuing a nuclear weapons program for years, and they want to put a stop to it. Israel bombed a suspected nuclear reactor back in 2007, but NATO doesn't want to do anything that drastic on a whim.
They would prefer to have some hard evidence before they take military action.
They want to catch them with their pants down. A source in the Syrian military intelligence told the U.S. that underground testing was going on near Araqqa, and since Syria is refusing to allow inspectors to visit suspected nuclear sites, we were to use a more covert approach.
Did this surreptitious inspection involve anything other than collecting air samples?
No. We were to fly in and out. They brought in some pretty big equipment with us to detect signs of nuclear activity from the air samples we'd bring back. We left Incirlik Air Base at 0200 as planned. We went east along the border for about an hour and turned south into Syria. We flew nap of the earth for about 12 minutes with an AGL of 80 feet. We reached the designated coordinates around 0315, collected air samples, and headed back the way we came.
Were you nervous?
You're funny. I get nervous if I forget to pay my phone bill. This is a little different. You're ground-hugging at 160 miles an hour over possibly hostile territory at night with night vision goggles. If that doesn't get your heart pumping, I don't know what will. So, yeah, we were both on edge. You can't see anywhere but straight ahead with the NVGs on. It feels like flying through a narrow, green-lit tunnel at an incredible speed.
Did everything go as planned?
Like clockwork. We were back in Turkish airspace in less than 25 minutes. I climbed up to 800 feet while we put some distance between us and the border. We were approaching Harran when we noticed some light directly below us. It wasn't city lights. We were over farmland, and the color wasn't right. Then, out of nowhere, the engines stopped, and the entire cockpit went dark. We could hear the rotors slowing down, and then nothing. There was this turquoise glow emanating from the fields below. Countless small bush-like trees planted 30 feet apart with nothing but dirt in between. We just sat there, staring. It was surreal, very peaceful. Then we dropped, like a rock. The airbag slammed into my visor and knocked me out when we hit the ground. I woke up a few minutes later. I was alone in the helicopter. An old man in a white cotton tunic was trying to undo my restraints. He must have been at least 60. He had dark, leathery skin. He looked at me and mumbled something he must have known I couldn't understand. And then he just smiled. Some of his lower teeth were missing, but he had very kind eyes. I regained my composure and helped him unstrap me from the seat. He helped me out slowly, putting my arm over his shoulder. Someone grabbed my other arm, a young girl, maybe 16 years old. She was very pretty. She kept looking down, spoke only a little bit when the man addressed her. He could have been her father, maybe her grandfather. They sat me down about 100 feet from the helicopter, and the man gave me some water out of a canteen. The young girl showed me a piece of cloth and gestured toward my forehead. As I didn't object, she put the wet cloth over my right eye. She removed it and quickly put it away, probably hoping I wouldn't notice the blood.
Where was your co-pilot?
I didn't know at first. It took a minute or two before I noticed several people gathered a few steps behind the helicopter. I couldn't make out any of their faces, only their shadows against the turquoise light. I got up. The young woman kept repeating the same few words. Don't get up, I suppose. I started walking toward the light. I made it to the edge of this huge crater that defaced the pistachio field. The light was so bright. Mitchell was there with some locals. He grabbed my arm and put it around his shoulder, then held me to his side. He seemed genuinely happy to see me. I'm not quite sure what we were staring at, but it was the most awe-inspiring thing I've ever seen. It looked like a whale, made of dark metal. Maybe a ship or a submarine, though it seemed a little small. It was sleek and curvy, like the body of a 747, but with no apparent opening, no propeller. It looked more like an Italian work of art than it did anything practical. Turquoise veins were running through the surface at regular intervals, forming a web-like pattern.
How long were you there?
I don't know. Maybe 10 minutes? We were distracted by the sound of other helos and the wind blowing sand in our faces. 4 Blackhawks landed around the crater, letting out more Marines than I could count. They brought Mitchell and me to one of the helicopters, and we took off immediately. The Marines on the ground were moving people away from the crater. I saw 2 of them attempting to stop the local police from approaching the site.
Yes, it was, unfortunate that the local authorities got involved. It would have been a lot easier had they arrived a few minutes later. Please go on.
That's it. There's nothing more to tell. I was taken to the infirmary at the base in Turkey. Then they flew me here for eye surgery an hour ago. How did you even know I was here?
Does it really matter?
I'll take that to mean you won't tell me. Can you at least tell me what that thing was?
The State Department is now asking the Turkish government permission to repatriate wreckage of a secret World War II airplane found by local farmers in the Urfa province.
You've got to be kidding. Some old plane wreck didn't bring down my helo. You really expect me to believe that?
What you believe is not particularly important at this juncture. What is important is what the Turkish government believes. What they need to believe is that we are taking a 70-year-old U.S. plane wreck back to America.
So what was it?
What do you think of Chief Mitchell?
You're not going to answer my question? Mitchell's fine. He handled himself well.
That is not what I meant. What do you think of him personally?
Look, I nearly died because there's a big, shiny thing out there capable of bringing down a fully armed Black Hawk helicopter from a distance in a matter of seconds. You really want to know what I think of my second on a personal level?
I do. I am well aware that your helicopter crashed. I would have to be blind not to see that you find it insufferable not to know why. If time were not an issue, we could talk about it for a few hours to validate your feelings, but I have to leave soon. You may see what I ask as insignificant. What you must understand is that I have access to a tremendous amount of information you are not privy to. Consequently, there is very little you can tell me that I do not already know. What I do not know, and what I wish to hear from you, is what you think of Mr. Mitchell.
What do you want me to say? I was with him for an hour and a half. We're both from Detroit. He's 2 years older than me, but we went to some of the same schools. He thought that was quite a coincidence we ended up on the same bird. He likes country music, which I can't stand, and neither of us thinks the Lions will make the playoffs. Is that personal enough for you?
What is his first name?
I have no idea. Ryan, I think. Are you going to tell me what that thing was? Can you tell me if there are more of these things lying around?
Thank you very much for your time, Ms. Resnick. Oh, I almost forgot. If it means anything to you, your former co-pilot also said you were the best pilot he had ever seen.
File number 007. Interview with Dr. Rose Franklin, Ph.D., Senior Scientist, Enrico Fermi Institute. Location, University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois.
Could it be the Davis experiment?
I do not know. Could it? What is the Davis experiment?
I'm sorry, I'm talking to myself. It has to be argon. I should have thought of that. My father worked at the mine for so long.
What mine? I know what argon is, but I am obviously missing whatever point you are trying to make.
In the late 60s, a couple of astrophysicists devised an experiment to collect and count neutrino particles emanating from the sun. I remember reading about it when I was a kid. They built a big pool of dry cleaning fluid, almost 5,000 feet below ground, to shield it from other solar phenomena. and basically just waited for neutrinos to hit it. When a chlorine atom is hit by a neutrino, it turns into a radioactive isotope of argon, argon-37 to be precise. Every once in a while, they would bubble up helium to collect the argon, and they were able to count the atoms that were hit. Beautiful science. They took something purely theoretical and managed to turn it into something concrete. They ran this experiment for nearly 25 years at the Homestake mine where my father worked, a couple miles from where I fell onto the hand. I'm willing to bet these things react in proximity to the argon.
I am not a physicist, as you know, but
I don't know anything about you.
Well, now you know I am not a physicist. In any case, I was thinking that the amount of radioactive material that could travel that distance must be infinitesimal.
It is. But however minute the amount may be, it can't just be a coincidence. The helicopter that crashed in Turkey was collecting air samples to detect signs of nuclear testing. That's what they would have been looking for, traces of argon-37. The pilot said they flew in some large equipment with them to Turkey. It would have been a MARDS, movable argon detection system, or something like that. In any case, it's a big machine that can detect argon-37. An underground nuclear reaction will turn the surrounding calcium into just that. It's a pretty reliable way of detecting a nuclear site. You can't hide from it. You can't cheat. Calcium's everywhere, in sand, in rocks, in people, and some of the argon that a nuclear blast would create will eventually escape into the air, no matter how deep the explosion.
You implied there are other isotopes of argon. Would it react to any of them, or just this one?
It would have to be just this one. There's a whole lot of argon-40 in the atmosphere, everywhere, other isotopes as well. But I agree, it does seem odd that these artifacts would react to something so specific.
Can you...
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I meant to say, unless, of course, they were designed that way. It would really be clever if they did that on purpose.
What do you mean? Who is they?
This might sound a little crazy, but hear me out. Suppose you encountered some civilization that's too far behind technologically for you to engage in any sort of dialogue with. Anyone capable of building these things would have scared the hell out of people 6,000 years ago. They would have been seen as gods, demons, supernatural beings of one kind or another. Now, say you wanted to leave something for them to discover, but only once they had evolved to a certain point.
How would you measure their evolution?
You'd want to know when they reached a sufficient understanding of the universe for you to be able to communicate with them in a meaningful way. It would most likely have to be measured technologically. It seems reasonable to assume that most or all species similar to humans would go through more or less the same evolutionary steps. Make fire, invent the wheel, those types of things. Flight might be a good criterion. Or space flight. If you can look up at the sky, it's safe to say you'll eventually try to find a way to get up there. And spacefaring species might at least be open to the idea of not being alone in the universe. Unless you were there to observe, you would need a way to detect whatever evolutionary landmark you chose. If you hid these things on a moon, for example, you'd know they'd only be found once they're able to reach that far. From where I stand, being able to harness nuclear energy would also be a pretty good criterion. Now, and this is the clever part, if you designed these things to react specifically to argon-37, they could only be discovered once that civilization managed to tap the power of the atom. This is all pure speculation, of course, but if that's what they did, I'm impressed. In any case, I think we have to take another look at the panels. We're going to need a linguist after all.
I thought you said there was no point.
That was before I knew about the argon. If that site was built there for us to discover, there has to be something in it that we can figure out. If you were to build a structure, say a temple, for your own people, you'd write things in it that make sense to you. But if you were building that same temple for someone else, you'd want what you write to also mean something to whomever you built it for. There's just no point in writing a message if you know the person you write it for will never be able to understand it.
Quite a few established linguists have already looked at the markings and come up with nothing. What makes you think the outcome would be any different this time around?
I can't tell you why it would work now. I do have a pretty good idea why it didn't work the first time around. They were looking for something that wasn't there.
And you now know what it is we are looking for?
I haven't the faintest idea, but I think that's a good thing. I think those who looked at it before failed because they knew too many things, or so they thought.
You will have to be a little less philosophical.
I'm sorry. Generally speaking, people tend not to question what they've been told was true. Scientists are no different. They've just been told a lot more things. As a physicist, it would never occur to me to question the four fundamental forces, for example. I take them for granted, like every other thing I learned, and I try to build on that. We always look forward, never look back. But this thing, it's different. It challenges us. It spits in the face of physics, anthropology, religion. It rewrites history. It dares us to question everything we know about ourselves. About everything. I must sound pretty philosophical again.
A tad.
I'd like to try someone not as well trained. Some hotshot student, maybe. Someone who doesn't need to throw the rule book out the window because he hasn't read it yet. We need to look at this from a whole new angle. I'll contact the linguistics department and see if they have someone to suggest.
It is an interesting concept. You want to find someone who is more or less unqualified because the people that were actually proficient have all failed.
I wouldn't quite put it that way, but yes, someone who's really smart and who's less encumbered with preconceived notions. It sounds a lot better when I say it.
It does. I suppose there is little to lose by trying, but you will forgive me if I do not exude enthusiasm. Did you receive the forearm from Turkey?
Yes, it arrived 2 days ago. We couldn't figure out if and how the hand was supposed to attach to it. Both parts have smooth, solid endings, nothing that would resemble a mechanism or a fastener. The end of the forearm is slightly concave, the wrist a bit convex, but there's nothing to hold the pieces together.
It was my understanding that both pieces were now joined.
They are. My point is that I have absolutely no idea how it works. We just moved them close to one another to see how they would fit, and they were drawn together like magnets. My assistant almost lost a hand. I can't talk intelligently about how the parts attach, except to say it made a very loud and very cool swoosh sound when they did.
Can you take them apart?
We haven't been able to. It's clear the amount of mechanical force required is more than what we can handle. I didn't want to risk damaging anything. I'd rather concentrate on finding the other pieces. I can't wait to see what the rest of the body looks like. We can try to take it apart once we finish building it.
So you think there are more of these things buried somewhere?
Oh, yes. It's killing me not to have it all right now. I may be getting ahead of myself. But I can't see how there wouldn't be. I could understand these being some sort of monuments or art forms if we had found another hand, a head, even a foot. But a forearm doesn't seem like something you would build for its own sake. It's not my area of expertise, but I can't see a forearm playing a strong part in religious beliefs. And if I read the report correctly, there was no chamber surrounding it in Turkey either. No walls, no markings. It's much too large to fit in the chamber the hand was found in, so it must have been buried elsewhere on purpose.
I agree. But they could have built just one arm, in which case all we could hope for is another piece.
Maybe. I still think there's an entire body out there just waiting to be found.
I hope time will prove you right. I really do.
I can tell you that if I were able to build something so magnificent, I wouldn't stop at an arm.
Based on what you now know, can you devise a process for detecting the other parts, if they exist?
If the rest of that body is out there? I'm fairly certain I can come up with a way to find it. I just have to figure out how to make a lot of Argon-37 and how to disperse it efficiently. It might take a while to find all the pieces, even once we have a method in place.
How long?
Oh, impossible to guess. Months? Years? If the body is divided along the major articulations like we'd expect, there should be at least 14 pieces. 3 for each arm and leg. That makes 12. A head, and 1 or several pieces for the torso. I can only hope that piece in Turkey was the exception, and that the rest of the body parts are closer to where we found the hand. If I'm correct, and they want us to find these things, they would have buried the pieces on land, where we can get to them relatively easily. I hope so, because searching the ocean is a completely different story. I'll have to request more funding from the NSA. I'm not sure how long this might take, but I'm absolutely certain I can't do any of it on our budget.
Forget the NSA. Just tell me what you need.
Forget the NSA? Remind me whom you're working for exactly. Wait, don't answer that. I'll send you a list of equipment. We'll also need a delivery system, possibly an airplane or a helicopter that can fly long distances. We'll need a crew, I guess, and a team to recover what we find. This part might get complicated. As far as body parts go, what we found were the smallest ones. They'll only get bigger.
We have teams that can handle the recovery. I will see about finding you some pilots.
We'll also need a bigger room, if this works.
How big?
Well, if their proportions are normal or human, he or she would be over 200 feet tall. We'll need a warehouse, even if we lay her on the ground.
You still believe it is a girl?
More than ever.
File number 009. Interview with CW3 Kara Resnick, United States Army. Location, Fort Campbell Army Base, Kentucky.
You again. What do you want now?
I only want to ask you a few simple questions.
What if I don't want to answer?
You are free to leave whenever you want, but it would be wise of you to stay.
Why do I feel like this is a test?
Because you are very perceptive. I am initiating a project to which you might be able to contribute, in one manner or another. You have, on the one hand, witnessed certain events and demonstrated certain skills that might give you a significant advantage over other potential candidates. On the other hand, your impulsive nature and your inability to work well with others are of concern to me, as they are to your superiors. With your permission, I would like to ask you a few simple questions, and for you to answer them honestly. Is that something you feel you can do?
Answer questions? Isn't that what I've been doing already?
I was not questioning your ability to answer questions. You have already shown great skills at eluding any inquiry of a personal nature by answering with another question. I am asking whether you believe you are able to answer honestly.
Does it matter if I'm not?
It certainly matters if you entertain any hope of being selected for this project.
You've already called me impulsive and unable to work well with others. It sounds as if you have a pretty good idea of what you think of me.
Let me present this to you in another way. Let us assume that I already know you are not suited for whatever task I have in mind, and that I have purposely chosen to fly here and waste several hours of my time for no other reason than to make your life a bit more miserable. Under this scenario, it would seem preferable for you to get through these questions as fast as you can, so that you may return to whatever it is you do now that you can no longer fly helicopters. I might also not be a complete imbecile and have a genuine interest in your answers. Either way, you have 10 seconds to answer each question. Are you ready? What are your 3 worst qualities?
My 3... Last time we met, you called me, what was it? Obdurate, volatile, irascible. I guess that's 3. I'm also vindictive, and I never forget anything. How many is that?
What are 3 qualities you admire in others?
Loyalty. Honesty. Courage.
Okay. You must answer the following statements with true or false. First one. You trust reason rather than feelings.
You want me to answer that with true or false? It's a bogus question. I know you want me to answer true, but sometimes you need to listen to your gut.
Then it sounds like your answer should be false.
But if I say false, you'll think I'm an emotional time bomb.
I might already be thinking that. I might also think you are completely heartless. You still need to answer with true or false.
False.
You often think about mankind and its place in the universe.
I do.
So your answer is true?
Yes.
You feel at ease in a crowd.
False.
You are usually the first to react to an unexpected event, like an accident.
True, I guess.
You like to assume responsibility for something.
True.
In a social event, you position yourself in the center of the room rather than on the sides.
That's an interesting one. I can't remember the last time I was at a social event.
Let me repeat the question. In a social event, you position yourself in the center of the room rather than on the sides.
I don't think I do. No. False.
You have difficulty expressing your feelings.
That's another bogus question. It depends on the feeling. I have no problem expressing anger. I don't think many people do. I could say the same about joy, gratitude, frustration, amazement. Things like love, fear, shame, desire, helplessness. Now that's another story.
That is a very well considered answer to a completely different question. Now, please answer this one with true or false.
But I can't. I just told you there is more than one answer.
This is unfortunate because this is a true or false question. Average it out. Do you have difficulty expressing your feelings?
Yes. True. My answer is true.
There is no need to get angry.
I'm not angry.
If you say so. You have a problem with authority.
You don't need a test to figure that one out.
It is a question. It is part of the test.
Oh. True. What, you're surprised? I know, now you'll ask me why someone with authority issues would choose a career in the military.
This is an interesting conversation you're having with yourself. Can we move on?
Yes, we can. I talk when I'm nervous.
You believe in the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence.
What?
You heard me.
False. What could that possibly tell you about me?
That you do not believe in extraterrestrial intelligence. Had your answer been true, I would now think the opposite.
You're very helpful.
Thank you. I will now give you the beginning of a story, and you have to finish it in one or two sentences. Do you understand?
I think I do.
Tommy sits on the doorstep alone.
Really? You want to understand the depths of me, and you come up with Tommy sits on the doorstep alone. That's just stupid. Why don't you just ask me what you want to know?
We could be here for quite some time if you do not answer the questions. It is a very simple exercise. It should pose no problem for someone of your intelligence.
Don't insult me.
I am not. I saw your file, remember? Your qualification testing shows you have an IQ somewhere between 125 and 130. That would make you moderately gifted. Therefore, as I said, it should not be a problem for someone of your intelligence to complete a small story in one sentence or two, even under a time constraint. Shall we proceed? Tommy sits on the doorstep alone.
Fine. His friends said they would come get him, but they didn't. Tommy's making up great stories in his head. When his friends finally come, he doesn't want to play with them anymore. Moderately gifted?
Next story. On the way to the supermarket, Lisa found a lottery ticket on the ground.
Do you come up with these yourself, or did a team of psychologists create these little gems? I mean, would anyone really say they'd steal it? Then again, what if there's no one around? It's not like you can Put an ad in the paper.
I do not believe
Never mind.
That.
Sure enough, there was a name and address on the back. She returned the ticket to an old man who lived a few blocks down. When the man died, she found out he put her in his will and left her everything. Is that touching enough for you?
Very well.